I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Nicholas Thompson is the CEO of The Atlantic, but he's also worked at Wired and The New Yorker. He's also the father of three boys and the American record holder for the 50K and a top-ranked world runner in his age group for the 50-mile run. Somehow in his free time, he penned his new book, The Running Ground, A Father, A Son, and the Simplest of Sports, in which he recalls how he got his start in running, how his father taught him lessons in unexpected ways, and why running is not the most important thing in his life. I recently spoke with Nicholas Thompson about The Running Ground, and here's our conversation. So the subtitle of The Running Ground helps to describe it: A Father, A Son, and the Simplest of Sports. Can you set up the book for us briefly?
Yeah, the story is about my life running, my relationship to my father, and how if you look really closely at running, you can understand some of the most interesting and most complicated parts of our lives.
You know, I started reading this book in July, and you began the book describing an early morning in November 2007 as you made your way to Staten Island to the start of the New York City Marathon. Yeah. I ran that marathon that year. I was there.
Oh, really?
I was.
So we were on the ferry together, maybe.
Possibly. You were one of the first to start. I was one of the last to start. But, you know, something you wrote captured my attention. That's the one beautiful thing about a marathon. Any finishing time can be a tragedy or a triumph. Can you explain that?
You know, marathons are these miraculous races where everybody is on the same course at the same time. Like, you don't get to play soccer in the same game as Ronaldo, right? You don't get to play baseball on the same field as Shohei, but you are running on the same course, the same day, and the same time as Eliud Kipchoge, right? So it's this beautiful thing. 50,000 people or 200 people, depending on the size of the marathon, go out and they run. And they're mostly not competing against each other, right? I don't care at all when I run, whether I finish ahead or behind of any particular individual. Sure, at the end of the race, if I see somebody a little ahead, I might be trying to sprint to beat them. But it's mostly against yourself, against your expectations, against past versions of yourself, against future versions of yourself. And so you cross the line and, you know, the audience can't tell whether you're disappointed, whether you've hit your goals. Nobody else knows. It's really up to you. I wrote that sentence. I was describing one finish line photo where I had done terribly per my expectations of that race. It was a Boston Marathon many years ago. And I'd been sick and I'd walked a bunch of the race. But next to me was this sort of this older woman with her arms up like this. And it was just a good reminder that that particular time, that particular moment, there's a disappointed Nick Thompson and an absolutely elated different woman.
This book is about running, but it's also a book about parenting. How you were parented by your father, how you parent your own boys, how your father was parented by your grandfather. In the acknowledgments, you wrote, "One of my central goals in life is to break the long string of Thompson fathers who have caused deep psychic angst for their children." So maybe we should start with your father. Who was Scott Thompson?
I mean, Scott Thompson is an absolutely remarkable man. He grows up in Oklahoma, mostly in Oklahoma, and he's scared of his father. His father's a Golden Glove boxing champion. He's a minister. He's this big, imposing bear of a man. And my father's not at all like that. He's like a kid who likes to listen to music, claims his first words are "Mama put on the Ina Kleina Nacht music," which can't actually be his first words, but still is a good story. And he escapes, right? Not literally, but he hears about the school called Phillips Academy Andover. He applies, he gets a scholarship, has to pay a little bit extra, and he's like been delivering newspapers on horseback, right? So he goes to Andover. He's got all the wrong clothes. He's, you know, doesn't really fit in, but he makes it. He like works his butt off, becomes one of the best students, gets a scholarship to Stanford, wins a Rhodes Scholarship, right? And now he's part of the American elite, comes back, marries my mother. My mother has grown up in this prominent New York and Washington family. Looks like my dad is on the path to the Senate. You know, John F. Kennedy, you know, jokes that this kid will become president before he does. But then life becomes harder for my dad. He begins to drink too much. He doesn't really get the success he wanted. And then he realizes he's gay. And it's a crucial breaking point in his life, and it shakes up everything about him and changes everything about him. He comes out of the closet. And in some ways, he's a civil rights pioneer. He becomes the first openly gay presidential appointee in United States history. But he also then starts to suffer from sex addiction, and he's got a real problem with alcohol. It just gets worse. And so his life kind of gets ever more chaotic. He goes bankrupt. He's off living in Southeast Asia. He's running a hotel that allows a lot of illicit activities, if you know what I mean. And so he's a brilliant, fascinating, always interesting man. He loves me dearly the whole way through. But it wasn't easy, being the son of this man and having to bail him out financially all the time, having to deal with, all of the chaos, the mess. He'd come to my house and order prostitutes. Like, who does that to their kid? And so he's an interesting character, let's put it that way.
Did you get your love of running from your father?
Yeah, this is another part of the story that's important, of course, is he becomes a marathoner in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and he starts taking me. This is before, like, while he's coming to the realization that he's gay. He starts taking me out for runs, and we'll go when I was like 5 years old. I would run a mile or 2 miles with him. And then I also watched him and I admired him. And I loved that version of my father, the strong version of my dad, getting up early in the morning, going and running. I went and watched him run the 1982 New York Marathon. I remember him running other ones like the Marine Corps Marathon. I thought it was great. And then we would run, when I was 11 or 12, I'd go visit him. We'd go running all the time. And then in high school, I started running. I ran on the track team and turned out I was good. From then on, he was always one of my biggest fans.
I remember when I turned 40 and a running friend told me that I'd never run faster than I was at that moment. That wasn't true for you, was it?
No, interestingly, right? My 20s, I tried really hard to break a 3-hour marathon, which is what my dad had run. And I can't do it. I struggle and it's hard. And then I do. It's great. And then in my 30s, I run a 2:43 marathon, which is great. Great, right? Really good time. Puts you near the top. I think I remember I came in 146th in the New York Marathon. And then I run, 10 years from 30 to 40. I'm basically running 2:43 after 2:43. But then in my 40s, I get way faster. And I run a 2:29 when I'm 44. And then I set the American record in the 50K. And then in April, I got the number one ranking in the world in the 50 mile. I've been in steady decline since April, but up to about age 49 and a half, things are getting better and better.
Let's talk about the title of the book. Can you talk to me about the significance of the phrase, the running ground?
I'm so glad you asked that because I spent so much time on the title. In fact, it was all I was thinking about. I was jogging in this morning. I was running to the office. I was thinking, why has nobody asked me about the title? So for a long time, I called the book Run for Your Life. And that's still what like my Dropbox folder is called, Run for Your Life. And kind of conveys what the book is about, running, life. But it's pretty generic, right? Any book could be called Run for Your Life, right? Any book about running could be called Run for Your Life. But I couldn't come up with anything better. And I spent all this time. I was like, should it be Time to Run? That's kind of cool, right? It's a nice title. Should it be something like more lyrical from one of my dad's emails? I couldn't figure it out. And then one day I was at our house in the Catskills, and I have this print that I love, and it's a long quote from Maximus of Tyre, and he's a ancient philosopher somewhat out of the Stoic tradition. And it's about finding love and beauty in whatever you see. And it says, humans are not able to understand exactly what God is. And so we label the things we love and the things we understand as God. And we do this with God and we do this with people we love. And we associate them with, the sound of a lyre or a running ground, right? And it's a print that has one of the most beautiful evocations of what the meaning of life is and how you should try to live and how you should appreciate beauty and art and everything around you. But even better, it is a print that my father gave me to pay off a loan. And so I was looking at it, and I was like, that's the title, A Running Ground. And it's distinct, it's so meaningful. And what's so interesting about it, I've had that print on my wall since I was 25 years old. And I had read it hundreds of times, And I don't think I'd ever paid attention to the fact that one of the things that Maximus says you can find beauty, God, and love in is literally a track. I don't, if you had asked me a year ago, what is he, I would have been able to describe it, and I would have been able to mention, oh, the rivers, and I wouldn't have mentioned a running ground. And then it just struck me. It was like a lightning bolt. And so I wrote to my editor, and there was some consternation because you see a book called The Running Ground on your window of your bookstore, and you might be like, "Huh?" Right? But you know what? It's the title. I'm so happy with it, and thank you for asking.
In a conversation you had with Arthur Brooks, you asked about the number one predictor of happiness, and he said, "There's only one thing you can do: get cancer and survive it."
Yeah.
And just as I ran that same marathon in 2007 that opened the book, I was also diagnosed with cancer the same year you were in
Oh my God.
2005. So can you talk to us about your cancer diagnosis? And also, do you find Brooks's statement to be true?
Yeah, wow, I didn't we have remarkable things in common. So I ran the 2005 New York Marathon, and it was my first really good marathon. I ran 2:43 right afterwards, like literally right afterwards. I go to the doctor, puts his hand in my throat, finds a lump, and won't tell the whole story, but 6, 9 months later, I've gone through multiple surgeries, radiation treatment, and I've been diagnosed with thyroid cancer, and it's been mostly eradicated, but completely wipes me out. I can't walk, and I'm terrified of death and confronting mortality in a way I never have. And so the book starts with the 2007 New York Marathon because that was when I came back, right? That was when I was able to really run. And in fact, I ran the 2007 New York Marathon slightly faster than I had the 2005 New York Marathon, 13 seconds faster, so half a second per mile than I had in 2005 before I was diagnosed. And what Brooks said to me, and he would say this 25 years later, 20 years later, 17 years later, sorry, math is a little off here this morning. He told me that because I was just in a bus with him asking. He didn't know anything about my history. But what is so interesting about my life is that my career was a real mess in my 20s. I couldn't get it sorted out. I didn't feel like I had found a place in the world. And then from about age 30 to today, professionally, things have gone rather well. I feel much more comfortable in my skin. My running has been great. I've got these wonderful children. Things have gone, objectively pretty well. And I wonder whether that's because I, in subtle and maybe not so subtle ways, reset my priorities, reset the way I lived, focused, paid more attention. The theory that Brooks lays out is that when you come to the precipice of death and you come back, you focus more, you care more, you have a greater appreciation for living, you recognize that your days are numbered, and so you live more deliberately. And you have deeper friendships, you find more faith in religion. Like, there's lots of things that tend to happen that you can't force it. You can't suddenly get to these realizations. You actually have to go through something terrible. So I do think that part of why things have gone better in my 30s and 40s than they did in my 20s is because of the cancer diagnosis and the survival. There are all kinds of other factors, and they're random factors and good luck and this and that, but I do think that that is a part of it.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the structure of the book. In addition
Oh man,
to,
you're hitting all the hard stuff. Okay, keep going.
well, in addition to recalling your experiences with your father and your experiences running, you follow five other incredible runners. Why these five?
I mean, I wanted this to be a book really about running and life and to get across some of the most important complexities and things you try to balance. Like, to be an elite runner, what do you have to put in and what do you have to sacrifice, right? What kind of pain can you suffer through? Like, what is the highest level of sort of spiritual ascension you can reach while running? And I can't even really approach those questions through my life because I'm not a super, I mean, I'm a good runner, but I'm not an elite runner. Like, I didn't get myself right to the, I'm not an Olympic level runner, right? And I run ultras, but I don't run crazy ultras. Like, I wanted to find runners who embodied more and different things about the sport so I could have a sort of a wider aperture. And so I interviewed tons and tons of runners. And I had a couple of rules. One, I would only include runners, I would only sort of write long stories about runners with whom my life had intersected. Like, I was not going to write about, a runner I'd never met and, There are all kinds of interesting people who have amazing stories, but I needed them to fit into my chronological narrative. And I wanted people who embodied really complicated questions. So the first one is this woman, Bobby Gibb. And she was the first woman to run the Boston Marathon. She's this incredible pioneer, and she's the most, like, I have a decently spiritual approach to running. Like, I love to run at sunrise. I love to run in the mountains, right? But this woman trains for the Boston Marathon as the first woman to run the Boston Marathon by driving across the country and every night going to a different park, running 20 miles first with her dog and sleeping under the stars. Like, that is the best way anybody has ever trained for anything, right? Drives from Boston to San Francisco and runs 20 miles in like every state along the way. And like, doesn't wear a watch, doesn't really know what she's doing, just loves the feeling of her feet hitting the ground. Like, this woman's incredible. And she's also the mother of a friend of mine. And so she comes into the narrative structurally when I graduate from high school, I win this award. She's in the audience in a little white plastic chair, and my drunken, obliterated father, storms the stage to congratulate me. And so then I cut to her life story. And so the narrative of the book is that each of these five people who embody something, the next is my, coach when I was about 30, who had helped use running to get through a really hard heroin addiction. Each of these people embodies these really big questions about running, but also fits chronologically into the narrative. And so the structural challenge for me was not just finding the right people with the right questions and the right stories, but fitting them in. And I had all kinds of different structures. Like, there's one early version of the book where Bobby, she's in chapter 2, chapter 8, chapter 14, right? And I've tried to align her life chronologically. And then eventually I realized, wait a second, I'm just going to introduce these people as discrete chapters, right? She will be chapter 3, Tony will be chapter 7. And I will have them, all the characters will be about the same length. Now, what was hard about that is a bunch of people I wrote about, and it didn't quite fit. And so I had to remove them. And I'm sorry about that to all the people I interviewed who are now not in the book.
One sentence you wrote stuck with me. People stop running because they get old. They also get old because they stop running.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this.
Well, I think that there are forces that make you go slower as you get older, right? And make it harder to run. You're lean muscle mass declines, right? Your maximal heart rate goes down. Like, there are things that make it harder to run, right? We decline physically. But most of the reasons we stop running are because our lives get too complicated and we have to take the kid to daycare and we've put on a little weight and, our parents are sick and, we have to go take care of them and the commute's too long. And then I think what happens is when we stop running, it speeds up the aging process. Like, I actually, everybody's like, how are your knees okay? You've been running for 35 years. I'm like, how are your knees okay if you haven't been running for 35 years? Like, it strengthens you. If you do it the right amount, it strengthens you, not weakens you. And so I feel like for some people and for a lot of people, when they let the sport go, that's when the aging process accelerates. And so for me, that means that I'm 50 now. I'm gonna keep going as long as I can.
Yeah, you seem to be highly functioning, highly disciplined individual. You wrote about, some of the very impressive jobs you've had from Wired to the New Yorker, and now you're CEO of the Atlantic. You wrote, "Running has never been the most important thing in my life. I've always cared more about family, about work, about many things." And you are able to balance family and work and running. And like, I'm a person who has a difficult time with life work balance and time management, and I'm one of those people who have let running go. Do you think the things that you are writing about can be learned, or are we just hardwired?
Oh, 100% learned that. Discipline is like it's a habit, right? It's not hardwired, and one can, like, I'm pretty good at habits. I'm pretty good at to-do lists. I'm pretty good at being efficient. I'm pretty good at like fitting in these runs and all that. I'm not perfect, and I've got lots of flaws. And if you want a full exegesis of all of my weaknesses, flaws, mistakes, my wife would be happy to come on for a follow-up podcast. But I think that the important thing is, running's been a big priority for me. And it's a big priority for me because I believe that it helps me with every day. It gives me a spiritual break. It teaches me useful habits, helps me not become my father. There are a lot of really useful, beneficial things that it does for me. It's not that important, though, right? What's really important is parenting. right? It's really important is like helping figure out a business model for the Atlantic so we can continue to publish important journalism and keep this magazine created by Ralph Waldo Emerson alive. And so, it's a secondary priority. And so if I have a real skill in life, my one skill, it's like fitting things like running into a day. So today I'm talking to you and I asked you whether we were going on video because I've got like my running clothes hanging up behind me because I ran into work, right? And it takes about the same amount of time to run to work as it does to take the subway. Now there's some trade-offs. You have to like hang your stinking clothes up in the office, which isn't great when you're the CEO and you're supposed to like be imposing and important. But I figured out how to make it work. And like I run and I listen to podcasts while I run. If I'm just doing a relaxing run and I'm learning from it, sometimes I'll do Zoom calls. I'm actually right now I'm doing some of my like rehab. I'm like stretching my quadricep because I've got a little bit of runner's knee and like making sure that my plantar fasciitis is, kept at bay with this little thing I've got on my feet. So, I feel like if you can squeeze it into other moments in life, that's a really good thing to learn. So I highly recommend that you figure out, run to the grocery store, right? Run to pick up the kids at daycare, run to, figure out where it is where you can fit running in without taking time away from the stuff that matters more.
Well, and you also said the weather is always good enough to run in, and there's always a spot to go.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about running, right? Like it would be much harder for me to like squeeze in lacrosse if that was the thing I really needed to do, because you need lacrosse. You need a stick and a ball, right? And you need other people, right?
Other people.
Basketball, you can kind of do, but you still need a ball, a hoop, and probably some other players, right? Running, you can just do it. And basketball's kind of hard to play in the rain because you slip, right? It's very hard to play in a hailstorm because the ball goes all over the place. Running, you can run in a hailstorm, you can run in the rain. Yesterday I was in Las Vegas, right? And I have like nowhere to run in Las Vegas, but went out, basically ran loops around the UNLV campus. The day before I was in Sea Island, Georgia, right? And found a little path, ran on the path. The day before that, I was like at a conference in DC. I snuck out for 40 minutes and ran around Anacostia. You just figure out how to do it.
I mentioned some of your impressive jobs, and you mentioned struggling in your 20s. And this sentence just kind of stopped me in my tracks. At one point, I was kidnapped by drug dealers in Morocco who held me for 24 hours before deciding I would be useless as an international drug mule. What?
Okay, here's a funny thing about this book. I worked really hard to make this book short, right? People don't have a ton of time, and I wanted it to be about running, right? It's not a memoir. I worked at The New Yorker for 6 years. The New Yorker is an amazing place, right? We covered the rise of Donald Trump. I covered the 2016 election. We're all these incredible pieces about Barack Obama. There's like nine sentences about The New Yorker there, or maybe there's five paragraphs, right? This is not a memoir. And so I only included in the book things that directly relate to my relationship to my father and things that directly relate to my running. And so this kidnapping story, if you were to write a profile of Nick Thompson, it's a pretty interesting story. I go to Morocco, just been fired from a job at 60 Minutes. I'm 22 years old. I show up at a train station. I've got my guitar on my back. It's like I'm like a classic naive young like white guy traveling through Africa. And I'm with a friend of mine. This guy comes up, he's like, "Hey, you want to come back, play guitar, Ramadan feast?" And I'm naive and stupid. My friend is like, "Dude, don't do that." I'm like, "I'll do that." And then he puts me in the car and like drives around really fast, brings me back to his house, locks me in a bathroom. The other crazy detail is he goes through all my stuff, but I actually had smuggling packs built into my backpack because I had a friend who was an interesting eco-terrorist who went on the run for 15 years. There are all these really interesting details in my life. But I condensed that down to like a sentence or two sentences. And the only reason it's in there is because I was showing parallels between my life and my father's. My father had been arrested as a man about the same age in Ghana. And it was just sort of a funny parallel between my life and my father's. But, if there was a real profile and a story of my life, you'd probably put more in about being kidnapped by drug dealers. But I had to include a little bit there, just a little bit.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
You know what my favorite reaction has been? My favorite reaction has been people who don't run read it and start running. Another reaction I've really liked is spouses of runners who now really understand it and are like, "Oh, I get why this matters to you in a way I didn't before." And My hope is that people will read it and they'll just have a deeper appreciation of this sport, but also a way of thinking more deeply about whatever hobby, sport, passion they have outside of the main things in life.
The book is The Running Ground. Nicholas Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Beth. It was really wonderful to chat with you. You ask amazing questions.
The Running Ground by Nicholas Thompson was published by Random House. Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new novel that revisits some favorite characters from last summer.
I've been a fan of Katherine Newman since the days of her original blog, Ben and Birdie, which chronicled her life as a mother of young kids. I fondly remember her lentil recipes and her board game reviews and her humorous takes on the messiness of daily life. She's kind of a modern-day Nora Ephron, with a talent for making the mundane entertaining. Her novel Sandwich was published last summer and became a word-of-mouth breakout hit, a manifesto for the menopausal that explored the blessings and curses of caring for aging parents while simultaneously raising young adult children. This fall, Newman returns with Wreck, which is set 2 years after the events of Sandwich. It finds main character Rocky back home in western Massachusetts and once again surrounded by family, her husband Nick, daughter Willa, and widowed father Mort, who has moved into a studio apartment behind their house. Newman opens this novel with a quote from Nora Ephron. "Death is a sniper. It strikes people you love, people you like, people you know. It's everywhere. You could be next. But then you turn out not to be. But then again, you could be." Wreck goes on to explore and embrace that attitude of sinking dread, with an atmosphere of anxiety bordering on neurosis. When a local young man dies in a train car collision, Rocky learns the victim was a classmate of her son's and becomes engrossed by the case. Meanwhile, she's dealing with her own medical mystery, a weird rash that starts spreading and defies explanation by her dermatologist and other clinicians. So Rocky Googles her symptoms and the nearly indecipherable phrases on her patient portal, and she becomes convinced she's not long for this world. Wreck is everything we've come to love about and from Newman, a blend of pathos and humor that gets you thinking about your own life and the people you share it with. As Rocky scours the internet for information about her newest collection of symptoms, the episode serves to define her and her husband's vastly different approaches to life. "His personality is very cross that bridge when you come to it," she says. "Mine is very apply to engineering school in case there's a bridge that might need crossing, but it hasn't been designed yet." Newman's stellar dialogue and keen insights offer several laugh-out-loud moments, including her visit to a dispensary for the THC equivalent of 1.5 beers, which ends up being a chalky, low-dose lemon-lime candy her kids call granny vitamins. Fans of Sandwich will appreciate revisiting Rocky and her evolving family, but Wreck could easily work as a standalone novel as well. And where Sandwich took us to the family's annual summer vacation in Cape Cod, Wreck has an autumnal vibe that leads up to Thanksgiving, and the annual reminder to be grateful for our flawed and beautiful lives. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Wreck by Katherine Newman was published by Harper. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.